Hello, I'm Dan Masterson, host of Strategy Talk, where we take a unique view of world events. We report news as history. With me today is the editor of StrategyPage.com and well-known military author, Jim Dunnigan. Associate editor and syndicated columnist, Austin Bay, also joins us.
Welcome, Jim and Austin. It's a new year, and as is our tradition, we look back at what's happened over the last year and then try to bring some organization like that to it. Jim, I'm pretty sure we'll be talking about the Middle East because that's about what the main topic we've been talking about for the last year. But what are some other things that happened during the year that weren't around the Middle East, per se?
Well, there's always been a lot of wars out there on the periphery. For example, we cover Burma, or Myanmar, as they like to call themselves. Decades-long military dictatorship gave up and allowed elections and got a lot of themselves elected, to the government, new government. But what's been going on in Myanmar for over half a century is tribal uprisings in the north. And in the last decade, that's become more complicated by Chinese investment in northern Burma to put in pipelines, build hydroelectric dams, all to benefit the rulers of Burma and China, because all the electricity and everything that goes through the pipelines goes straight back to China. That's low level, off the radar. There is some unrest in Central Asia, but that is totally ignored. It's the same old story, corruption. And people basically are happy with ineffective and, greedy, rulers. In many cases, these are guys who were bureaucrats during the Soviet Union period. And when the Soviet Union collapsed, they said, we're still in business. And this stuff causes a lot of low-level warfare that doesn't really, count to most editors as wars at all, but people are dying, and they're shooting and explosions. Meanwhile, possibly the biggest ignored war is the one Austin covers regularly, and that's in the Congo, where millions of people died in the last 20 years with very little media coverage, partially because it's very dangerous, partially because it's the literal and literary heart of darkness. It's in the middle of nowhere. It's difficult to get to, and it's difficult to stay alive when you get there. Not only Congo, but also Uganda, and of course Somalia is not far from there, as well as Kenya. These are all places with not much, prosperity for the population, but since the end of the Cold War, there's a lot of cheap AK-47s, and there are minerals, especially, that are valuable to the developed world, and a lot of warlords and, basically gangsters have set up mining operations, which they will defend with a lot of firepower, and a lot of the locals just get killed, bystanders. And there's going to be more of that in 13. It just never ends.
Austin, what are the ignored areas that come to your mind?
Well, Jim brought up Central Africa, West Africa, East Africa. Jim covers Nigeria. Nigeria's got a really significant ongoing a conflict that is, it's tribal-based, but it also has a religious component, northern Muslim tribes up against southern tribes that are predominantly Christian or animist. Look, I don't think this was ignored. It was an oil war, but it certainly didn't get some of the other press. And whether you want to call it in the Middle East or not, it's in the transitional zone between sub-Saharan Africa, and it is the transitional zone between sub-Saharan Africa and quote-unquote the Arab Muslim Middle East, and that's Sudan and South Sudan. We had in a real border war with, to a limited extent, maneuvering armor, certainly artillery, airstrikes by the north. Yeah, they're using Antonovs, that transports that have been reconfigured to, so they can push bombs out the back, but they're still aircraft capable of delivering delivering bombs, and the that's about on the Sudan, Khartoum, we northern Sudan's part. They also have a few MiGs. But the south has is limited with what it can do outside of having a few heavy machine guns. When they do a they shot down one, perhaps two Sudanese Air Force helicopters as well. Sudanese Khartoum uses helicopters with machine guns on and some automatic cannon as a attack helicopter. So that was that's a pretty significant, Dan. And part of the play in that too is it moved at a geostrategic dimension that involves China. By the way, we'll come back to China again in a moment. The Chinese have invested a lot of oil in the Sudanese oil fields. And, oh, depending on how you slice it, and that's one of the problems between Sudan and southern Sudan, is South Sudan got around 75% of the producing oil fields and probably got more, based on the geological reports, of yet to be potential reserves. There's... China intimately involved, both with Sudan and now South Sudan. And South Sudan did something rather radical. They shut down their oil fields because of an ongoing crisis problem with the North. The North has the pipelines and the ability to export the oil through Port Sudan. And in other words, on the Red Sea, and they were charging an absolutely exorbitant fees for the transport to the oil, the South objected. Now, that was one part of what led to this war, and right now it's a frozen war, and depending on who or what you read, there is, are anywhere between 250,000 or so northern refugees up to, you know, so depending on what you see, 500,000, 600,000 refugees from the north that have moved into the south or into refugee camps in Ethiopia. That's because Sudan and these wars, the internal wars in Sudan, Khartoum, South Kordofan, and Blue Nile states, usually have tribes that are really coulda, shoulda, woulda been part of the south. Several of the Nuba tribes are Christian. Some of the other tribes there are animists. And there are even a couple of Muslim, ostensibly not Muslim tribes that think the, because of ethnic ties, would prefer to be part of the South. And then there's the Abyei area, which was supposed to have been solved by the 2005 Comprehensive Peace Agreement that ended the North-South Sudan Civil War in 2005, and Abyei is has an Ethiopian peacekeeping brigade under UN UN flag sitting there to try to keep Sudan and South Sudan, basically to keep Sudan from absorbing Abyei, which also has some oil fields. Well, there's now. So I just mentioned Ethiopia. Jim talked about Kenya, talked about Uganda. I mean, the Lord's Resistance Army is still in play. And actually, the LRA got a lot of media attention, Dan, in 2012 because of that video, Kony 2012. Recall, I did write a couple of columns about it, and it's in some of the Uganda sections. We mentioned it. There was film and I've watched it. It has a lot of it is accurate. It's also in some ways simplistic, and of course it paints Joseph Kony. I happen to agree with the way that it paints him as a depraved a killer. But why the one problem with it is that Tony's not unique. He's typical of a lot of these warlords and rebels that you see throughout sub-Saharan Africa. Jim was alluding to some of them that crop up in the Eastern Congo, and they commit heinous crimes. They survive by terror. You know, they don't have any other way of population control, they think, other than machetes and hack off people's hands and commit terrible crimes in order to silence the civilian population, because they're being chased. The LRA is being chased actually by an African Union force now, that includes Ugandans, Southern Sudanese, some UN peacekeepers, and you have still deployed to chase the LRA, 100 U.S. Special Forces advisors that are advising on logistics, intelligence, and the like. So there's an international force with that. Now, I said we'd get back to China. One of the things that did get a lot of press, but there are China's actions in the South China Sea. I noticed on the internet just a couple of weeks ago, there were a couple of articles that were saying what's mine is mine and what's yours is mine, was the Chinese attitude towards some of these islands and reefs in the South China Sea that are claimed by, well, Vietnam, potentially Cambodia, even though Cambodia tends to line up with China, certainly the Philippines, and Malaysia. And this is another resource war at one level. Jim mentioned all the very valuable minerals in the Eastern Congo. Well, some of the seabed of the South China Sea does have oil and gas deposits and may have other useful minerals for, Jim's used the term, developed nations, high-tech minerals. And China's throwing its weight around. And it's throwing its weight around so that the Filipinos, who kicked the U.S. out of Subic Bay, you know, bye-bye imperialists, now want a new relationship with the United States Navy. And Chinese are frowning about that. Now, Korea, North and South Korea, the Korean War is still on, Dan. Another frozen war. That certainly got a lot of press. But in some ways, press that doesn't quite comprehend I shouldn't say that. I read a lot of things that come out of Asia in English, and they do understand that dimension. What is going on in North Korea? Are they really building a bomb? Yes, I think they are. Have they got an IRBM with extended range now? Yeah, they do. Is it accurate? We don't know. Can they hit Japan? Can they hit Seoul, South Korea? Yes. And that's part of the extortion racket that North Korea's been running now for approaching two decades, which is if you knock out Seoul or knock out Tokyo, hit it with even conventional weapons, or the like, you deal a harsh blow to the global economy, because they're such important centers of information, production, and finance. Do note, though, that the South Koreans are getting very tired of it, and there have been, and we covered this on Strategy Page, that South Korea has developing a relationship with Vietnam. Vietnamese have a deserved reputation as high-quality soldiers. They don't have a lot of money, and they do need new technology to compete with the Chinese. And the South Koreans say, we've got some technology, and it's not an alliance, but it has the framework. It has a clear understanding that is understood in Beijing. These are both nations that have solid military reputations, South Korea and Vietnam, and they're united because they see a common problem, which is with growing Chinese power. And heaven knows that Vietnamese fought a border war in 79 with the Chinese, and they've also had at least two major incidents on Chinese Navy or military forces knocking the Vietnamese off of disputed islands in the South China Sea. We had the dispute too between Japan and China over the little islands, the Senkakus, I think is what the Japanese call them, Daiyus. I'm mispronouncing it, but the Chinese name for it, and those are really north of Taiwan. That pits the second largest economy in the world against the third largest economy. That's a good way to understand the significance of that. And so I've talked through those. You wanted to stay out of the Middle East, but you've got. Do you consider India and Pakistan to be in the Middle East? Jim's already talked about Burma, which is on the other side of India. You've got your stuck folks. We are all stuck with a world that is chronically at war and chronically afflicted with low-level violence and really. Medium-grade violence, and I guess I ought to bring up the one group that did get some media attention in the Congo, Democratic Republic of Congo, this year, and that was M23, so-called March 23 movement. They now call themselves the Congolese Revolutionary Army, and that involves Rwanda, according to the United Nations, and it involves ethnic Tutsis who are Congolese and the Tutsis who are in charge in Rwanda. That did get some international press, in part because there was a vote to sanction or recommendation to sanction Rwanda for its support of M23. But note the irony, too, is that Rwanda has been one of the UN's most consistent providers of troops for UN peacekeeping missions over the last, really, Dan, 10 years. Rwanda got one of the coveted non-permanent members of the Security Council seats, and it wasn't denied, despite being threatened with sanctions for allegedly supporting the M23 rebel militia in the eastern Congo. Does that sound complicated, Dan? It's because there are no easy answers to it.
That's right.
And I've kind of gone on with it, but between the problem with getting Jim Dunnigan and Austin Bay talking is that, you know, we followed this stuff for 30, 40 years, you know, so, and it hadn't changed.
Jim, haven't heard a lot from Central and South America. Well, what's bubbling down there?
Well, two things about Central and South America. First of all, the drug trade and smuggling the drugs and producing them dominates, you know, the criminal activity down there. Secondly, we tend to forget that all of the Americas, especially South America, have always had a very high rate of gun crime, or gun use, I should say. We've mentioned this several times in Strategy Page. I've seen very little about this, you know, in the mainstream media. Although, you know, now because of the massacre up in Connecticut last year, there's more calls for gun control. But be that as it may, the Americas have always had more of this violence, with or without guns. And that's a mystery that no one has been able to unravel. But there it is. That's sort of a war, as it were, that is so pervasive that nobody notices it. You know, it's just what goes on. Most of the bloodshed in the world, in the past and in the future, has to do with money or religion. I mean, this is something that you can't help but pick up on. You know, reading or writing, as the case may be, Strategy Page for, you know, years and years. But I've been doing this sort of analysis for decades, and, you know, basically it hasn't changed. The money angle is largely tied up in the illegal drugs. I should also point out, which this tends to get missed, that the reason why the hard drugs, especially the opiates, were outlawed in the first place was that when they were freely available, they were a huge problem. And we tend to forget that. That never comes up. You know, legalizing this stuff is seen as a panacea, and there are no other problems. There are plenty of other problems. And believe me, they will come back very quickly if you make this stuff, you know, freely available. Well, anyway, while it's illegal, it's very profitable. And this causes, you know, big problems in South America, especially in Colombia, but also in Ecuador and Peru, and also in Central Asia. You know, Afghanistan is basically the source of 80-90% of the world's heroin. And the previous main source of heroin, the Golden Triangle, basically northern Burma, is getting back into business. That's a whole other story which we cover in our Burma section. They're also big in the amphetamine, you know, meth, which is a big drug over in that part of the world. And religion, as we know from Islam, it's become politically incorrect to blame Islam for a lot of this terrorist violence. But as we point out, another brave, you know, websites mainly point out, this is an endemic problem. I mean, Islam was a religion that was the only major religion that was founded as a an army. As, you know, it was basically founded and spread in war. You know, their idea of propagating the faith was conquering people and selling, you know, basically convert or die. As the generations went by, they eased up on the, you know, do it or else. They said, all right, if you don't convert, you got to pay heavy tax. And so it went. That, as one would, you know, presume, you know, just thinking about the logic of it, you know, ran out of steam after a while. And it's just been sitting there festering ever since. But people who are believers in Islam have an easy way to pick up on that, because many of your Islamic conservatives cannot help but basically, you know, adopt the the attitude that you have to be militant to be a good Muslim. You know, jihad. I mean, a lot of Muslims will say, well, jihad is really about just struggling. And he says, yeah, but when you get down into the scripture, it's about struggling with a, you know, a knife or a gun and shooting at the infidels or, you know, the non-Muslims. And this is the basis of all of terrorism. I mean, this is why most of the terrorism going on in the world for the last few decades has been Muslims. I mean, there's no mystery. And this is going to keep going on. There is a movement within the Islamic world to try and change this, but you're talking about fundamental tenets of the religion, which are not easily changed. And so we're going to keep seeing more and more of this in the future, even though we've got put a damper on it, but it's a just congenital condition. It's not going away.
Yeah. Your thoughts on that, Austin?
I would add the other component. Jim's covered it, you know, money, and of course he's focused on the smuggling component. I talked earlier on, and Jim did as well, as resources. I mean, resources are an old raison d'etre for war. I'm just talking about China, but some of the smaller fights that you see in Ethiopia and in Sudan, South Sudan itself. South Sudan's conflicted by tribal battles, often over water holes. The resource component is another element, but then I also mentioned tribalism, tribes, ethnicity, that gets lost sometimes amid all the crime, but there's an intersection between the criminality in some places and ethnic groups that are engaged in smuggling and in it as well. I mentioned the M23 movement in the Eastern Congo and the Tutsi connection there. There's an example of where it's, you know, there's smuggling of valuable minerals, but there's also the tribal tribal element, and one of the things that the spillover from the Rwandan genocide with a radical Tutsi group, the Interahamwe Hutus, Hutu tribe, you know, killed 700,000 to 800,000 fellow Rwandans, most of them Tutsis. Some of them were Hutus who were not radical enough for the Interahamwe group, and that had a the many of the radical Hutus who engineered the genocide fled to the Eastern Congo. They became the Democratic Forces for the Liberation of Rwanda, FDLR. You'll see that as their acronym for them. And so the Congolese Tutsis, seeing, you know, the border was drawn by European imperialists, said, you know, we're going to help our cousins, our brothers out. So they were the origins of, at least one of the origins of M23 was in that, that they were providing intelligence and some degree of a buffer for the Rwandan Tutsis who had taken power in Rwanda and were still threatened by the Hutu radicals now in the FDLR. And that has a ethnic dimension, tribal dimension, a tribal dimension to it. So, hey, look, tribe, ethnicity, money, and Jim said religion. And those,
right.
I think somebody in 500 BC would have recognized those as the sources of the bitterest conflicts at that time.
Yeah. Jim, what is the one or the several events that stand out in your mind that happened over the past year? We'll wrap it up with that with Austin's comment.
Well, I think, you know, Syria, the death match, as it were, between the Sunni tribes, Sunni nationalists, whatever you want to call it, the Shia or Alawite minority, and it's basically its patrons in Iran and Russia and China, you know, just so odd. It's bizarre. And, of course, the rebels are winning, but at great cost. I mean, the casualties are probably close to 60,000 now. And, you know, running over, you know, 500 or 2,000 dead, you know, a week, and most of them civilians. And nobody's really willing or able to intervene. You know, they say, well, no, we got to let them take care of themselves. And also at the same time wringing their hands saying, well, gee, there's a lot of Islamic, you know, radical organizations in there fighting for the rebels. What's going to happen to them when it's all over and they're part of the victorious coalition? Gee, might that be a problem? You know, this is called smart diplomacy, but in retrospect, in hindsight, it might, you know, seem to be something else. Again, one never knows. I mean, you know, getting involved in a war, especially a civil war, is a losing proposition, but we may find out that not getting involved is as well. Now, that said, there are a lot of things being done off the books to be involved. You know, when our ambassador was killed in Libya last September, one of the things he was heavily involved in was organizing the shipment of Libyan weapons to the Syrian rebels. And that was, you know, kept quiet. It still is, both for the sake of the new Libyan government and for, you know, American politicians. And the Arab countries, especially the oil states, are trying to get weapons in there. But you're dealing with corruption. You know, that's something else. I guess I should mention that. It's taken for granted. But corruption, massive corruption, pervasive, you know, really harmful, painful corruption, is also at the basis, one of the sources of a lot of the wars going on in the world. The inability to govern yourselves fairly. And, you know, it's easy, you know, for us in the West, you know, to underestimate that. Although I think we're seeing some of it in the United States because the United States has become, much like we were in the 19th century, very corrupt. Apparently the new movie called Lincoln, the one I think with Daniel Day-Lewis, from what I've heard, it covers a very corrupt period in American history. Although some people are going to go to see that and say, gee, that sounds like our Congress today. Be that as it may, this corruption does have corrosive and ultimately, you know, violent, you know, side effects. And as bad as it is in the United States or some parts of Europe and Eastern Europe, it is horrible, you know, in the Middle East and, you know, places like Pakistan. I mean, you talk to some of the people who've fled those countries and come to America. There's a lot of them in New York, and I've met them. You know, it's a conversation I sort of dread having, but at the same time, it's fascinating in a grim sort of way, perverse sort of way. But, you know, they're just talking about the things that people, politicians and the police and what have you, get away with, and why it's so great to come to a country where the cops will arrest you if you try and bribe them. I mean, they'd love that, you know, where people mostly stop at red lights. You know, it's things we take for granted, but in many parts of the world are rare. And a source of great, you know, basically anger and ultimately, you know, civil war, rebellion, unrest.
Austin, what do you think?
Yeah, I'm glad Jim brought that up. There's a problem that's emerged for the United States. It's one that I heard actually in the mid-1990s from some states that were, America was urging Eastern European countries after the collapse of the Soviet Union and collapse of the Warsaw Pact. I'm talking about 93, 94. I'm saying you've got to get your politicians out of the trough. And though this will take it back to the early Clinton administration, they were saying, well, the Clintons were allegedly involved in Whitewater House. What does America have to say about it? I'm not raising this to get people scream Republican and Democrat. I just remember that was something that came up when our State Department policies, and to some degree there would be the Department of Defense representation, Treasury, and the like of this, were actually trying to do what I'll call some intelligent, providing intelligent advice about restructuring your country after having been in a really under a Stalinist military dictatorship for 50 years, and before that, some of the Eastern European countries smashed by the Nazis as well. And it was, look, this is the way a modern developed society works and a rule of law. But the comeback was, oh, okay, well, does America have its own act together? And what we have seen really over the last few years here in the United States, Dan, is the growth of real cronyism, I mean overt cronyism, to where government investment in an array of quote-unquote new technologies, and the businesses go belly up, and that's how is that quote-unquote different than some of these other countries ask, and what you Americans have condemned? That's why Jim a few minutes ago was saying corruption in America, you know, it's starting to look like elements of, and I like this comparison, elements of the 19th century, just to, so we don't get letters about this, what I was saying about the mid-1990s, one of the most crooked administrations that ever existed in the United States was the Grant administration. And Grant was a Republican. I mean, you could say the same thing.
And a very popular guy.
Yeah, a very popular one. And he wasn't crooked himself, you know, but it was just, rampant. And, you know, they talk about the quote unquote Chicago politics now. Chicago's been Republican. It's just Democrat now, but it was still the same, cesspool. The kind of, crony ridden, crime ridden, government, cesspool, and the claim that you would get from, I remember Mayor Daley, Richard Daley, we're the city that works, yeah, and as crooked as you could be at the ward level on up to the city level, and look at the number of political leaders, including governors, both Democrat and Republican, in Illinois that end up going to jail. In fact, as I'm just again to be fair about this, I think the last Republican governor is still in jail, Dan. If not, check it out. He's done his time and gotten out. But the crookedness results in not just white collar crime or raids on the Treasury that you see here in the United States or in the developed world. It is a component of revolutionary violence in several places on the planet. And just as a look back at 2011, the common thread running through Arab Spring, as well as some of the other revolutions of 2011, there's one that you heard in 2009 with the Green Movement in Iraq, which is the governments are corrupt. The system is corrupt. Heck, my column for this week, I wrote it on January the 2nd, day before we're recording this, about Egypt, the great Satan that Mohammed Morsi and his Muslim Brotherhood government, the Muslim Brotherhood dominated government of Egypt faces. It's not the United States, and I'm not connecting him to Khomeini. The great Satan was Ayatollah Khomeini's line during the Iranian Revolution to describe the United States. Satan is our own corrupt, unjust, and poverty-ridden system there in Egypt. And that's another formulation of what, when several weeks ago you were asking Jim about Morsi's, the prospects for Morsi's government, and this was before the Islamic constitution was approved and all of that. And Jim says, if he doesn't solve the economic situation, they're going to go find somebody else who will. Well, there it is. That's the real enemy. And if you spend your political capital getting a Sharia enshrining constitution or the like, well, you missed the battle. And to some degree, that's a battle against corruption. Are you going to be part of the solution and in the corruption, President Morsi? Are you going to spend your time fighting a religious battle, an ideological battle? And then as your country continues to slide into a poverty-ridden mess. And look, Muslims, secularists, Christians, liberal Muslims, in Egypt, that was the thing that combined, brought them all together. We're poor, and the situation's crooked. We want something else. So, yeah, I'm glad, that Jim brought that up because he's dead right.
Well, next time we get together, we'll take a look at how corruption, religion, ethnicity is going to affect us in the coming year, and where we're going to see things remaining
well, Jim,
hot.
Jim had money. Money.
Oh, and money. I forgot about money.
Resources,
Yeah, when you don't have a lot of money, you don't think about it a lot. we'll talk about how that's all going to affect us in the coming year as we normally do in January. So we'll talk to you both next time.
Happy New Year.
Bye.
Happy New Year.